Hi, my name is Barry Gill, and I am the head of investments at UBS Asset Management. So many myths and misunderstandings surround China. It's complex and diverse and never fails to confuse and confound the West, but its geopolitical and economic importance is without question. It demands our attention, and we cannot really afford to ignore it. To some degree, at least, we must put ideologies and stereotypes aside and find ways to remove our biases. Only then will the real China emerge in our minds, the one that lies behind the headlines, the one that leads the way in renewable technology, the one that values security over freedom, the one that is socially and environmentally conscious in ways that we in the West don't quite yet understand. Like everyone this year, I've been forced to sharpen my thinking on the investment case for China. We came into the year with high hopes for the economy and the financial markets there based on a post-COVID reopening. As we all now know, all too well, this really hasn't materialized. In my attempt to make sense of events, I came across a book called The New China Playbook by Dr. Kei Yu Jin, who I'm delighted to introduce here and to have the opportunity to interview. I found the book remarkably balanced and thought-provoking. This perspective is perhaps unsurprising given Dr. Jin's background, having spent her early childhood in China and moved to the U.S. as a teenager to attend high school and further education. Her book, in my mind, is a refreshing take on China that spans a wide range of topics, from technological innovation to trade, from consumer and savings habits to the demographic and psychological hangovers of the one-child policy, from finance and corporate competition to the unique and delicate dynamic between central and local government, also known as the rise of the mayor economy. More than anything, though, it forces us to think of China as a dynamic country and economy that is changing in front of our eyes. Set on a transformational path by Deng Xiaoping, China has reformed and opened up. Some of the lines between capitalism and socialism are blurring. Yet only some of our mental models have updated as rapidly to reflect the new realities. As Dr. Jin sees things, the old playbook was one of industrial subsidies and technology transfers. But a radically different younger generation is set to reshape China's future. The new China that is emerging is dynamic and exciting, but by no means perfect and not without risks. So with all that in mind, Dr. Jin, can you explain why you wrote this book and what you hoped to achieve with it?
Well, my book starts with the sentence, "Reading China in the original, not lost in translation or in perspective." I think China, this large, complex country, is often misunderstood. I want to provide a perspective from the inside. I would like to give, even if we're talking about economics and politics, a cultural and historical lens, and to reduce the misgivings that often divide the East and West. And as time goes on, especially recently, as tensions rise, the need for understanding this country and the differences and Chinese aspirations, the developmental model, and where it is going in the future, I think is critically important.
So what do you think is the single biggest thing that we in the West get wrong about China?
There are many, but if I were to name one or two, it would be, first of all, China's model. Now, people think about China as being an extremely centralized state, top-down decisions, but a more accurate characterization of the Chinese development model is political centralization, but an extreme form of economic decentralization. And if we look at the localities, the local government officials all around China, they're highly entrepreneurial. They're doing their own thing. They're implementing economic programs, protecting the environment, now pursuing high-tech and hard-tech technology and innovation. And it's very decentralized. So that makes it very different from anything, really, what we have seen around the world and in history. But I also like to add that the misunderstanding of the Chinese people is also so important and it's important not only for understanding China as a whole, but also the political economy. The Chinese people, the fact that they've always had to balance the deference to authority and their independent exertion of free will It's part of the cultural traits. You know, we've had to deal with that since we were young, whether it's between us and parents, us and the teachers, or the Chinese people and the Chinese emperor, or now the Chinese people and the Chinese state. It's never been black and white. What are considered to be often irreconcilable paradoxes to the Western eye are often not so in China. They can coexist.
So a lot of people tend to think of China as a command and control economy. You touched on that just there, but can you explain how the mayor economy works and the sort of intricate relationship between central and local government, how that comes together in China? China, the whole seems, you know, everything seems much less black and white than we tend to contrast it.
Well, interestingly, in Chinese, it's a lot funnier in Chinese, mayor economy and market economy sounds very similar, 市场经济 and 市长经济. So that might have just been identical to that you're unfamiliar to Chinese, but one is mayor economy, one's market economy. I think it's kind of a name, an anecdote, to capture the fact that local provincial governors or party secretaries or mayors, these local officials, are highly motivated to develop to their local economy, whether it's innovation or whether it's pushing through these hard reforms or social stability, maintaining social stability or protecting the environment. They are in charge and they take great responsibility and they're held accountable. So the great leader Deng Xiaoping said in 1978 that reforms start from breaking rules. It was incredibly difficult to think about how rules could be broken after the Cultural Revolution in a country that was highly dogmatic and steep in these identity struggles, how to think about breaking the rules. But it was in fact the local officials, mayors, I call them, but really these local cadres that broke rules and then made these ultra successful economic zones with opening up to investment and to trade. And that once one was successful, not only did that mayor gain recognition and was able to be promoted to the higher rung of the political hierarchy, that model was rolled out throughout the country. And that's how China reformed, remarkably so, in the last 40 years. That rapid growth really started from these high incentives of local officials. And fast forward to today, that political economy model is still very important, because when we think about technology and China's great ambitions for innovation and the new era of technological prowess, the local officials have a lot to do with it as well. If we look at the unicorns, technology companies in particular, in China, they're distributed all over the country, not just in Shanghai, Beijing, and Shenzhen, but even in Wuhan, Suzhou, Wuxi, Nanjing, Chengdu, and of the likes, the second tier cities. I don't know if any of you have heard of the city, 5 million people of Hefei, but they're home to the Global Quantum Avenue, where we can find Chinese companies that have excelled globally, or the headquarters, or where it is the headquarters of the top EV company NIO. And the Hefei government was very entrepreneurial. They invited these great entrepreneurs, they invested in them, or even if they didn't invest in them, they helped them coordinate coordinate the supply chain, or financing from banks, attract talent. Effectively, these local officials were building mini Silicon Valleys all around the country. And it was not directed from the central government. The central direction was pursue technology, protect the environment, save the economy. But it was really up to the local officials how to interpret that and how to implement it. And so that synergy between these local officials and the private entrepreneurs is very nuanced. The West has somehow bought into the idea that the state suppresses the private or the private entrepreneurs, but it's in fact the opposite. Because if you think about it, the local officials need the private entrepreneurs even more than the other way around in this day and age, whether it's for tax collection, revenue collection, or employment, or undertaking technology innovation. And with the success of many of these private companies, The service industry flourishes, retail, and even the real estate that the officials own are worth more. So their incentive is very, very much in line with promoting the best and the most productive entrepreneurs, because otherwise these entrepreneurs would just flock to the neighboring region or city and then earn credit for that official and that mayor instead of this one. So that internal competition between the mayors and the party officials and that tournament actually acts as a very important checks and balance that very few people are aware, even in a politically central country like China. And even today, when it comes to protecting the environment, recently I visited Dali in Yunnan. I mean, the lake Erhai is so well preserved and, you know, well protected now, so different from many years ago. And that comes from that state impulse, that local project and mobilization. And so I think it's really important to understand the mayor economy in combination to the market economy to understand the Chinese economic dynamics.
So I like that word tournament that you use to sort of define the competition that the cities or the mayors have as they fight for entrepreneurial growth in their designated area. Clearly, that component of the Chinese economy has grown dramatically over leaps and bounds over the last decades. But there are still a lot of state-owned enterprises driving a large chunk of the Chinese economy. Can you just maybe tell us how the SOEs have evolved over the last few years and how you see their role in the future? And one of the things that came through earlier on this year was, I don't know if it came out in a paper or a statement, but the state-owned enterprise regulator added improving return on equity to the list of key performance indicators for the state-owned, for the SOEs. And, you know, I'm just wondering, I think there's some degree of skepticism as to whether anything can really be achieved on that metric, which is a very pure capitalist metric, whether that can actually be, anything can be achieved if there's no real economic feedback loop to management of these SOEs. So do you have a perspective on this?
Well, first of all, you talked about evolution, and I think it's very important. Because SOEs have evolved over time along with private enterprises. And in fact, the rise of private enterprise in the private sector has pushed the SOEs to reform because they're suddenly in competition. Now, it's true that there are a certain number of sectors, strategically important sectors, in which the SOEs still have monopoly power. But gradually over time, their share of the economy is substantially smaller than what they were before, despite the fact that we think that the state exerts more control over the economy only in certain strategic sectors. But if you look at manufacturing or their service industries or gradually technology industries, it's really dominated by very productive private enterprises. But again, they push each other. And a really interesting phenomenon that has occurred, and again, tells you that the line between the state and the private or their collaboration is very nuanced, is that the state enterprises now often take an equity stake directly or indirectly in the private enterprises. And so even if the numbers of SOEs are smaller over time, they do have that network that spans this entire corporate network and capital, where they have equity stakes of many, many productive private enterprises. And that relationship is also interesting because sometimes it's actually highly desirable for private enterprises to have a big SOE as your major stakeholder or a significant stakeholder, because then it helps you get over some of the barriers to entry, or helps you with local with financing, and that relationship could also play an important role. And there has been a feedback between the two, private and SOEs. So if we look at the data over time, SOEs have actually gotten more productive, despite what we think. And a large part of the reason is that there have been reforms, and the private enterprises have been making competition more difficult, so they're ousting the less productive, and there's a positive market selection mechanism that's pushing the SOEs. Still, the SOEs are still less productive than the private enterprises on the whole, but they are evolving over time.
So just taking it in a slightly different direction, the investment theme behind China has been about infrastructure spend for so long, right? 20 or 30 years at this point. And that has meant the Chinese economy has become, relative to other global economies, somewhat imbalanced. What needs to happen for consumer confidence to grow in such a way that the savings rate declines? And are there any developments that you'd like to see in the financial sector that that could really support this type of transition?
Well, first of all, there is a severe lack of confidence in the Chinese economy currently. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that during the pandemic and post-pandemic, China did not see a major stimulus package, demand stimulus package in the way that Europe and the US had was able to enjoy. And so I think that also explains a significant part of the very tepid recovery after the pandemic. For the savings rate to significantly fall, I think it will take time. And this is not a confidence issue, but it's also a habit issue, a cultural issue, an issue that has to do with housing prices, and as you pointed out, a lack of financial sector development. If we look at the younger generation, which I hope to talk about a little bit later, their spending habits are very different from the previous generations. 85% of aggregate consumer credit is taken up by people under 35. And they spend, and they don't really save for a rainy day in the way that older generations do.
Right.
And so I think, you know, that's part of the reason. The financial system, it really is the last dinosaur standing in the economy. In fact, it's reformed very little. If you look at aggregate credit, 80% of aggregate credit is intermediated by banks. That's a typical feature of an immature financial market, as those as the developing countries. And only 15% of aggregate credit comes from capital markets. And so the problem with that is that you have layers and layers of financial intermediaries in the financial system, so that when you're in the bottom of the food chain, like a private company, small or medium sized, you're getting really, really high cost of real cost of capital, because it just simply cost of capital adds up as we go through the layers in the financial system. And they enjoy, sorry, they have the burden of double digit real cost of capital compared to an SOE, 3 to 5%. And that also brings to the point of why stimulus, monetary stimulus is often not as effective in China, is that the reason is that that credit gets stuck in the financial system. And that again has been very slow to reform.
Okay, it's very interesting. Now, China's GDP and the stock markets are famous for how uncorrelated they are. You have some interesting theories as to why that could be the case. Could you elaborate? And I think people kind of have to look under the hood a little bit more to understand what's going on. So maybe you could take us through that.
Yeah, one really puzzling phenomenon in China is that whilst it has been the most remarkable economy in terms of growth in the last few decades, it's had almost the worst performing stock market.
Right.
And if you put in a dollar in 1990, in a dollar equivalent portfolio weighted, then you would pretty much have gotten that dollar back, you know, 15 years later. And so, and also, as you pointed out, there's correlation between economic fundamentals and the stock market is almost zero, which makes China in the bucket with Iran, countries like that. You know, the correlation for US or UK is above 50%, sometimes 80%, and that correlation is zero in China. So that's quite puzzling.
Yeah.
But I guess anecdotally, it fits with a view that it's been very difficult to make money as a, you know, normal investor, retail investor, especially in the Chinese market. And so part of the reason is that there is a strong selection mechanism. Well, first of all, you know, in the Chinese, when you get listed, you have to go through this approval system. So it's not registration basis, as is the case in the US, but China's moving towards that currently. And the conditions are very stringent, very difficult to list yourself on IPO with your consecutive years of certain kind of profitability and so forth. And so a lot of these companies actually strain their resources or do things that are not good for them for the long term for the short goal of being listed. And so you see them get listed and then You know, a year later, their stock price drops by on average 50%. And so the average stock decline post IPO is significantly larger than those in other countries. But what's also interesting is that Chinese companies, equivalent Chinese companies that are listed in overseas in the Hong Kong market or in New York, perform much better. And that relates to the fact there's corporate governance issue in China. So now we know of the story of Evergrande, but there's so many Evergrandes around. Companies get listed and you're a pharma company and you start buying golf clubs or start to produce an EV or buy soccer teams. And so that kind of spending, right, investment, horizontal expansion without focusing on core business, because some of them also even invest in real estate. That level of corporate governance issue is also really very important, explaining why the return on investing these stocks is low. But hopefully, there's a lot of focus on reforms for the stock listing process, and the Star Board, which is the Chinese version of NASDAQ, et cetera, would help and welcome these great Chinese companies that don't necessarily see a profit yet, to be able to list in domestic markets rather than choose to list overseas as well.
So it's a really interesting topic, because what you've been able to see in that type of environment, were to persist, being an active manager is where you'll want to be. And the same level of indexation that we've seen in other global markets is unlikely to persist until the capital markets normalize and the stock markets normalize in the direction of those Western markets. So it'll be very interesting to see how that develops over time. You talk about moving in a slightly different direction. You talk about many seismic but unintended consequences of the one child policy in the book. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Yes, the one-child policy is something that's close to my heart, both because I've done research on it, but also because I was born in the first batch of the one-child policy generation in the early 1980s. it's extremely interesting. I think on the negative side, I think these population policies might not have been perfectly designed to the point that now we have a demographic issue, because having been used to having a small family with no siblings, the current generations have changed habits in terms of not wanting necessarily a bigger family. And it's also broken some of the social fabric, the family fabric, traditions. Some in some ways very good, because there used to be such a hierarchy between the parents and the kids, the authoritarian kind of family, and now there's great equality. In fact, the children are sometimes enjoying higher status than the parents because there's only one child. There's also been other economic consequences that have been totally unexpected. My research focuses on the fact that it explains a huge part of the high saving rate, basically because you just spend less if you have one child. And you also have to save more for your old age retirement, because in the past, previous generations, you had five kids. They're going to help support you in your old age, whether it's cohabitation or income support. And we see that very much in the data, that people who had more children had more post-retirement support in aggregate. And now you have only one child, you save a bit more for yourself. But the other economic consequences and social consequences are very, very fascinating. because there's only one child, I call it trading quantity for quality. So you raise the quality of the children by giving them huge education investment. But that's also led to the greatest anxiety of the Chinese society today, which is education competition. Anecdotally, or something that's very telling, is that the most popular national TV series is about how to get your kids in school. So you can feel the angst of the parents all around the country, and the economic and financial burdens of just educating one kid, spending up to a third of your household income. You can imagine that pressure also, yes, a huge part of your income, and that pressure also extends to much poorer families. And so parents feel very anxious for the fact that if they don't have 8 tutorial classes for their kids, then they are falling behind from the starting line, as they say. And hence the crackdown on the education sector, which has partly alleviated some of the issues, but not totally resolved that, again, that tournament style mentality, because you have only one child. Now, on the flip side, there has also been really great positives. In particular, it's led to a golden era for Chinese women. In the past, as a daughter, you were educated after the sons were, which meant that most of them were not educated. But now you have a daughter, you will educate a daughter like you educate a son. So after the one-child policy, with the right kind of timing, the convergence of higher education between men and women have totally closed. And actually the returns on education of girls have been actually higher than of boys. Also, as you can see in the data, whether we look at publicly listed companies or even in the political system, the number of female leaders, the share of female leaders have just really shot up. If you look at the later generations, post-80s, post-90s, compared to the previous generation of post-50s or post-60s. And so I think that's been an unexpected plus of having fewer children to raise the status of women. But going forward, I think that that change in habit is very important, reducing the education costs so that people have the desire to have more children for the benefit of the country is very important. Having enough space, so affordable housing, so that you can rear children in a proper environment is also very important to be able to encourage people and the newer generation to have more kids.
So as the parent of a single child, I can echo a lot of the comments that you've made there, and I'm certain that I'm going to have to save a lot for my retirement. So, look, you know, if you talk about some of the negatives and the positives, but obviously this is a whole generation of new Chinese people, right? That are effectively different because they've grown up in a completely different environment to their forefathers, and not only from a demographic standpoint, but obviously also in a very different economic environment as well. So these differences, you know, we're seeing this in the U.S., right? The as the millennials become much more significant part of the demographic and their spending power changes, their biases also get reflected in that spending. So what's this going to do? How's this going to affect consumption patterns, if at all, given, as we talked about before, the consumer economy is so such a small part of the overall Chinese economy? And then what are the big investable trends that might emerge from following this cohort's activities?
I have high hopes for the new generation for a number of reasons. First of all, if you look at the surveys and data, it definitely shows that they're much more open-minded. They care about diversity. They're much more socially conscious. They care about worker inequity, inequality, the environment, all the way to animal rights in Africa. And I think this is part of the reason of a maturing. It's because partly the country is maturing. It's a young economy. It's an old country, but it's a young economy. And as it matures, as it prospers, there is more scope to care about things other than just putting bread on your for your family on the dinner table. And that's what this new generation is about, greater empathy and humanity, which I think will also give China a greater soft power that connects better with the rest of the world. But also in terms of other habits, they've also changed. Consumption, as I mentioned, they are huge borrowers. They like to spend, and with the benefit of technology, one click on Taobao, on Alibaba, you're a university student, you can borrow without an income to buy a lipstick. That might pose other problems, like consumer borrowing, which might become a problem sometime in the future, but you know, maybe they get their parents to repay because everything is intergenerational transfers and altruism. But it goes to show that they have a very different mentality and a different psyche. Now, the new generation loves to have not only consumption, but lifestyle consumption, traveling, spending on things like apparel and food. I forgot the numbers, but they spend at least twice as much on things like food and clothing despite having much less income than the previous generation.
So twice as much in dollar terms or twice as much as a share of income?
Twice as much in aggregate terms, but even in terms of shares, it's probably even more, much higher, because they earn less. I forgot the precise numbers, but it was very surprising. And it fits with, what we observe about the new generation Chinese, street fashion, high fashion, the fact that in second tier, third tier cities, you have many, many, much more exciting, retail and coffee shops and, juice bars and restaurants than you have in Beijing and Shanghai, because the new generation has taken over and they want to transform their economic landscape into something that fits with their lifestyle, and they travel. And so I think that's going to push China to become even greater consumer economy, plus the traveling, so that benefits the rest of the world. They're also a more relaxed bunch. You hear about lying flat, this kind of notion of not just giving up, but not necessarily to the extent of giving up, but just being more relaxed, less ambitious, less hungry. They are a generation that's very different from the Foxconn workers that opted for three shifts a night just to earn an extra little bit of income. They're highly educated. they want to enjoy life along with working hard. And of course, they're entrepreneurial stars that would be, the most hardworking and disciplined in the whole world. But I think by and large, that generational shift has made the new generation somewhat more, convergent in values with the rest of the world. And in terms of what kind of sectors are very appealing, first of all, there is a lot of competition in the consumer sector. But even if you look at the snacks and the Maotais and, the specialty coffees and all of that and the apparel, luxury conglomerates enjoy a premium, especially the hard luxuries and the very well-known foreign brands. But if we go a few layers below that, there are a lot of national brands that are, that very much appeal to the younger generation. And, they're going to spend more things on beauty. So cosmetics is a great area, healthcare, in the sense, they're going to go to the gym now. They want to have healthier choices. So again, typical of that cycle of going from, when I was growing up, McDonald's was a luxury. Oh my goodness, I had to get such great score. I had to get really good exam scores to be able to have a few bonuses, McDonald's Happy Meal bonuses. But now they're going to opt for, higher quality things. And they're highly innovative. They're transforming their physical world into the online world in really important ways. They think about innovation as solving practical issues. So they observe the busy urban lifestyle and they think about really innovative ways to make people's lives just a little bit better. So it's a very, very different mentality.
So my favorite chapter in the book really focused on technology, and it was my favorite chapter because some of the things that you hit on are things that I try to think about a lot. You talk about 0 to 1 and 1 to N innovations. So maybe and there is this, it's right that you've divided it that way, right? Because there are these assumptions out there with respect to where China can and will compete. So can you explain what you mean by 0 to 1 and 1 to N, and why this is useful for understanding China's and ultimately the world's technological future? Are there clear inhibitors to China winning in the 0 to 1 space? And is there anything different in the current administration that would impair the rate of innovation we've seen in China over the last few decades?
If we look at innovation, what the definition of innovation is, it actually is quite broad. It's, whatever that makes something better, less costly, higher quality, should all count as innovation, not necessarily a first of a time thing. And so any processes or products that make us leaner and cleaner, greener, more productive, all count as innovation. And that's what actually matters in the end, from an economic point of standpoint. And so 0 to 1 are what I believe are fundamental breakthroughs, breakthrough technologies, going to Mars or curing cancer or, you know, the first computer or steam engine. One to N is, you know, applications or improvements based on existing technologies, equally important, potentially even more important. I think it took 100 years between the invention, you know, the full realization of steam engine to be, you know, to be reaped, and many, many innovations along that fundamental breakthrough.
Agreed.
And so China's been very successful from one to N, whether it's processes or efficiencies or business models. If you think about it today, I believe that still even today, 4 out of the 5 top most downloaded US apps are Chinese. Apart from TikTok, there's a fashion app called Shein, and then Temu, which is Pinduoduo's outpost in the US. And it just goes to show that Chinese business models are world-class and they're being copied. You know, they used to be copiers and they are being copied now, and they're highly innovative. So as successful as these applications have been, I think still very important. Again, if we think about, you know, the majority of the people living on Earth today are still living in developing countries. What they need are not some just most advanced technologies, but they actually need technologies they can use at affordable prices. And this is what China can offer, even ahead of advanced economies. But breakthrough technologies, and I want to say that there's also a difference between mastery of high tech and breakthrough technologies. And I think for the latter, China can do hard tech. China can master high tech because of cumulative knowledge, the talent pool, the engineers, the scale, the financing. So earlier this year, an Australian think tank have put out the research report that shows that China leads on research in 35 out of 44 of the cutting edge technologies.
Right, it was fascinating, that report.
Absolutely. And even though there's a difference between research and commercial output, but even if you look at the actual things that China has been able to make and do, I mean, even just simple things like MRI machines, you know, China used to import all of them. And now China makes its own 90% lower cost than an American one. Or the fact that the Huawei has come out with a new phone defying US sanctions and, you know, Chinese grasp of critical technologies in so many areas, just goes to show that mastery of high tech is very much feasible and has been, you know, in many ways attained by China, even though it's behind the US on breakthrough technologies. And I think breakthrough technologies goes to something much deeper, much more profound than money, markets, and talent. It goes to goes down to the whole society as a whole, the civil society. To do breakthrough technologies, you need basic research. You need a patient country with patient people and patient capital. So it goes back to the financial system. You want people to be intrinsically motivated by curiosity and passion rather than just being extrinsically motivated by short-term profits and returns. And that's the things that we admire about the US, the scientists and the collaboration between universities and industries, but really fundamentally coming from a desire to make impact and change rather than short-term goals. So I said in the book, short, flat, fast, as having captured a certain kind of national psyche. It came from a volleyball strategy, but it was also used to describe investment strategies and then marriages. But that to capture that it's an impatient country because you've seen so much growth in such a short period of time that if you don't have a unicorn after 3 years, you are a failure. That kind of mentality also prevents you from some doing great, even if it lets you do something good. So I think it will take time for breakthrough technologies to really be a focal point. Actually, to have no focal point or no goals at all is a starting point for a country that wants to do these kind of 0-to-1 technologies.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And the Huawei phone obviously caught a lot of people off guard, and I had to look into it myself. And it'll be very interesting. This seems to be the limit of a DUV, deep ultraviolet lithography, which the Chinese companies have been able to acquire. But to go to shrink the node even further, you're going to need EUV or extreme ultraviolet. And that is the stuff that is now embargoed. So there may be a false signal that we're getting in terms of the pinch that the embargo is having. But if China figures out a way to make that leap from DUV to EUV on its own, that will be a very, very interesting development.
I think this is just a beginning. Huawei is just a beginning of a whole national mobilization. And we can't underestimate how many other companies are working on this, potentially even through alternative routes, alternative methodologies that will circumvent these restrictions. Potentially, you can domestically manufacture a 14 nanometer chip that has the same or even better capabilities as a 7 nanometer. That would be very useful for EVs and, you know, other kinds of applications. So I think it just goes to show that within such a short period of time, these, you know, there have been already quite a bit of achievement, and I think it is just a beginning.
And just belaboring this, you talked about this intrinsic curiosity. Does that exist on the ground? Are all of the necessary ingredients to feed that there in China?
Well, it existed in history, if you think
of course,
about
absolutely.
But I think it's deeply wedded in the Chinese ecosystem, the traditions, right? If you think about the curiosity, intellectual curiosities of Confucius, but also the fact that meritocracy was the bedrock of 1,000 years of feudal society in China, just goes to show that there is such an emphasis on long-term intellectual pursuits. And interestingly, ironically, in the past, many of these people kind of shunned commercial applications because they thought it was just too, you know, banal. And even though China invented, you know, the gunpowder and the compass, they weren't really, you know, the applications weren't really of great interest to the Chinese. And so that I think that will come back. I think it will come back when people are just seeing a bit more normalized growth rates rather than these, you know, extreme bursts of growth where everybody felt compelled to have to do something and be part of that wave, to grab something, grab the pie somehow. I think it's not necessarily a bad thing that China normalizes to a more normal growth rate and with greater emphasis on quality, on sophistication, on niche, on specialization, and I think that will return. But I'm not sure when, but I think it will come back.
So, Dr. Jin, property. It's almost impossible to do an interview on China without touching on this topic. Much is made of the overall leverage in the Chinese economic system and how much of that relates to property. From your perspective, is it really that bad? What was it Ray Dalio referenced, the concept of deleveraging gracefully? Is it possible to do that? And if property deflates even slowly, what, you kind of touched on this a little earlier on, what impact will it have on consumer confidence?
In short, and in the short run, it's going to be it's going to be difficult to find something to replace property as an engine of growth, because it was just that massive. And it was just that straightforward to implement, especially with China's political economy model and the economic decentralization that we talked about, and the fact that real estate was the half of the revenues of the coffers, local government coffers. So there was a lot of incentive to develop it. And so, you know, in the past, people wanted, local officials wanted to do industrialization. And then when the real estate boom happened, they wanted to do urbanization. And so all these incentives were kind of aligned to roll out real estate at a rapid pace. But I think that in the long run, there is a gradual, or let me put it this way, the new equilibrium will take time, and the market will find a new equilibrium. I don't necessarily agree that there's no pent-up demand and that supply way exceeds demand, because if we look at urbanization, it's still got a long way to go. We still have hundreds of millions in the rural areas who want to have a house or apartment in the urban areas. Housing ownership is very important for the Chinese individual and the Chinese household. So everybody wants to own a property. It's still a growing economy. And I don't really think demographic ethics is really the most critical point here, because again, reaching a higher income or reaching the middle income by international standards is way more significant and applies to almost a billion people here. But I think it's going to be a painful adjustment, a slow process, very controlled on the way down. So we don't really know what the actual, kind of extent of real estate price decline would be. There would certainly be quite a bust, and that would affect consumers and confidence even further. So I think the thinking is that the government will try to avoid a hard landing, and then, depending on the circumstances, adjust the amount of support that they're willing to give the real estate. And in terms of the debt, a lot of the debt will be absorbed by commercial banks. As I mentioned in my chapter, give very explicit reasons why I think a financial implosion or major financial crisis is less likely to happen in a very controlled, state-coordinated, bank-dominated a financial system like China. But along the process, there will be debt weighing on growth, weighing down on growth. There will be a lack of confidence. We've seen, investment in property being substantially negative and dragging down overall investment. Over time, supply will have to adjust, and meeting the slow growth in demand. There is some cause of concern because there was only 76 million registered, sorry, 7.6 million registered new marriages last year out of hundreds of millions of millennials. And so people are not only not having kids, but not getting married either. That's going to put some pressure on housing prices as well. But I don't think it's a doom loop situation. I just think it's a painful long adjustment downward.
So the final question I have for you is on the context of sort of soft power. The Belt and Road Initiative has been in place for over a decade now. What's it achieved? What are its weaknesses? And how do you see China's sort of soft diplomacy evolving? And what do you make of the evolving expansion of the BRICS? And maybe contrast that with the legacy role of the G20.
The Belt and Road was initially a very ambitious project. It was China's answer to a new paradigm of globalization, not only in trade and investment, but building a global network based on physical or digital infrastructure and greater connectivity. And I think that made a lot of sense because when we look at pretty much everything today, it's part of a network. Productivity is part of a network. Infrastructure is obviously a network. And so you want to connect the nodes, and then you want to be the most central component of that network is a very smart thing to do, right? But I think over time, that idea was good, but it's the Chinese ambitions have run ahead of the global reality, which is that yes, China can have the financing, can construct infrastructure, but not all the economies were ready for that scale of infrastructure before the economy were really producing these jobs and the activities. You built the roads, but then, and that I think that does help a great deal in terms of trade, and that should help with growth. But a lot of people are asking, yes, that we have great roads, but what about food? How do we earn food? So I don't think that's up to the domestic economy to solve, not up to China. But still, I think there's been a little bit of a mismatch of timing, and hence some of the debt issues have arisen. But I also think that there's been a great deal of a misunderstanding about the debt issues involved with Belt and Road. And here I want to spend a few minutes to clarify.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of research and a lot of data collection by international organizations around this issue. So a few things. First of all, the quality of Chinese investments in Belt and Road projects have dramatically improved, as well as the countries and regimes they've worked with. They've also shifted from just state-to-state collaborations to collaborating with private enterprises, and building efficient projects So the quality has risen over time between 2013 and even 2019. And second, the debt issue. The majority of emerging market debt is held by Western financial institutions, not China. And so I think there's been a little bit too much blame on China for domestic debt issues. And as we know, all emerging countries, way before their rival China, had had debt problems, sovereign debt issues, and indebtedness that's got really nothing to do with China. So China is a major creditor to emerging markets, but where it relates to Belt and Road is still a very small proportion, considering the entire debt picture. And then the third misunderstanding is about asset seizures. There's been no asset seizures in Africa. There was one case in Sri Lanka, maybe one or two, but really far and few between. And even there's been a lot of misunderstanding, and some local Sri Lankans will come out and say that, the blame that has been put on China on that particular issue is actually quite unjust. So I think to summarize, I think that the idea is good. The implementation has not been so great. You can also argue that there has not been a great involvement of many different parties other than the Chinese participants. But at the same time, it is an evolving thing. I think China now being financially constrained, fiscally constrained because of internal economic issues, has less appetite and less room to undertake these large programs externally. So we're going to see that change as well. But it's also been a learning process for the Chinese. But infrastructure is so important. Infrastructure is one of the three or four critical conditions of helping countries get to a higher income level, escape the middle income trap. And China has enjoyed that privilege of being more productive because of infrastructure. And it did want to offer that to the developing world and South, but I don't think all the stars were aligned to do that.
And just on the BRICS versus G20 topic, how do you view that evolution?
It's really very important. I think, emerging markets have a strong desire to both have a greater voice and say in the global international monetary and financial system and global system, trading system, and is pushing to create a coalition of powers that counters or balances out the Western powers. So we see that move very clearly in all fronts, including when it comes to an alternative system to the dollar, whether it's a parallel system to SWIFT or internationalization of the RMB, current currencies that can be freely traded among the emerging markets, and alternative paths to circumvent US inspection on and scrutiny on these financial issues. So you do see that push, and you're going to see that stronger and stronger over time. So I don't think BRICS itself is just a concept, that it's an empty thing. There is a real push to do things differently. And I think South to South trade, more trade among the global South and more regionalization is something we're going to see as well, in part as a response to the geopolitical tensions globally and the unreliability of the global supply chain and so much uncertainty. So I think it's just a response to the fact that the rules have been written down by a handful of countries that not necessarily answer to the real conditions and real needs of the emerging markets. I mean, take the 2009 financial crisis. The US had a system of a liquidity support for six advanced economies, the swaps with the six advanced economies, and there was a big gaping hole left open for the emerging markets. And when global institutions like the World Bank and the IMF come into these developing countries, they have strict conditions and conditionalities imposed that are sometimes, in their view, not in the interest of emerging markets. And so China sees this very differently, being an emerging country itself and a great creditor. So it's more sensitive to some of their needs. So I don't think this is at all an empty thing. I think it's a very important trend to watch.
So, Dr. Jin, thank you very much for your time and for sharing your perspectives on such, frankly, a fascinating and largely misunderstood country. I hope that our viewers will have gleaned as much insight as I have from the exchange, and I look forward to staying in touch. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.